Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
Are you looking to serve God and society? Consider putting your gifts to work as a lawyer. Ave Maria School of Law has been educating faith-filled lawyers for over 20 years. Ave Maria School of Law is committed to training lawyers to use law appropriately around the moral issues of our time. Visit avemarialaw.edu to learn more about integrating your faith with a law degree.
Looking for a way to build daily prayer discipline? Seen the rise in mindfulness meditation, but not sure if it is possible to meditate in a way that's consistent with your Catholic faith? Just looking for a way to breathe new life into your existing prayer routine? No matter what you're looking for, Hollow is here to help. Hollow is a Catholic prayer and meditation app that helps users deepen their relationship with God through audio-guided contemplative prayer sessions. From meditations on the daily gospel, to the rosary, to daily examines, Hollow has something for everyone. Hollow is the number one Catholic app in the U.S. It is free to download and has permanently free content, but you can also check out all of the premium sessions for 30 days, risk-free, by signing up at www.hollow.app/breadbox.
Good evening, everybody. Good evening, and welcome to Beneath the Surface here at WCAP Radio. Beneath the Surface, where faith and reason meets every Monday evening between 10 and 11 p.m., attempting to bring a little sanity into our age of insanity, a little life into our culture of death. My name is Paul Morano, your host, and tonight we delve beneath the surface on the problem of suicide. Depression, suicidal ideation, and finally hope. And to discuss that all with me is my guest for this evening, Miss Kathleen LaPlante, author of the book Unraveling My Father's Suicide. Kathleen, welcome.
Thank you. It's so good to be here.
It's great to have you.
It's been a while.
You know, it was, I think you were a guest in one of my very first BTS radio shows back in 2013, and we talked about this topic, but you just began writing a book, so that wasn't finished,
right?
And so we talked about it in general, and we ended up losing that tape, I think. Either it wasn't, the producer didn't tape it at that point, or what have you, but for some reason it's gone. So now we're going to even do a better show because you finished your book, Unraveling My Father's Suicide, and I finally picked it up and read your entire book. It was very good. You can get your book where?
On Amazon.
Amazon.com.
It's the easiest.
Kathleen LaPlante is the author, and the name of the book is Unraveling My Father's Suicide. And during our conversation here, if you would like to give us a call here at WCAP, our phone number is 978-454-4980. That's 978-454-4980. Or give us a comment on my website, paulmorano.com. Okay, let's get right to it, Kathleen. I'm sure there's a lot of people who can relate to this topic in general, mm-hmm. and who might get a lot out of this conversation. Why did you write this book?
It's funny, I thought you might ask that question.
Oh, good, well.
My dad's suicide happened over 30 years ago.
Okay.
And I think that the book was in me for a long time, but I was busy raising kids, working, and, you know, just doing the typical stuff that everybody does. And my kids grew up, they went to college, And while they were in college, that's when I started writing the book.
Yeah, so it was in your heart to do, and finally you had the time and the wherewithal, and you finally got it. Once you get right. something like that started, that's the hardest part, isn't it?
Starting it?
Yeah.
I think you're right. It is difficult.
Let's just, before I get to some specific questions that relate to your book, let's give a general portrait here. You grew up in Manchester, New Hampshire. Right?
Yes. Yep.
You were one child out of five.
Out of six.
Out of six. Were you the youngest?
No, I was second to the youngest. I have a younger brother.
Okay. So were there two boys and four girls?
Yep, that's
okay.
right.
Two boys and four girls, and you were the second to the youngest. And by and large, you grew up in a household that was, would you say, poverty-stricken?
Yes, I would say poverty-stricken.
And most of what you grew up in was public housing?
Public housing, and my father was an active alcoholic, so that was in there too.
Okay, so your father and mother had problems in their marriage because, well, perhaps mainly or at least partially because he was an alcoholic, and he used to go down to the local bars all the time, and you used to find him there to the neglect of his family.
Yes.
Okay. Eventually, I mean, after all of this, and by the way, your father, according to the book, was once in a while abusive to, not only abusive in the neglectful sense to his children, but abusive also to your mother in a sometimes verbal, if not physical, way.
Both. Okay. Yeah.
Right.
And I think I write about, well, no, I don't think. I did. I did write about those in the book.
Yeah.
Even to the extent that in one incident, the police came.
Okay.
Because it was so bad. And my father was arrested and, you know, brought to the police station.
So at what point in your life was your father, did your father leave the home?
I want to say that it was when I was around, it was very early on because, well, let me see. You mean like leave and not come back?
Yeah.
Okay, because for many years he actually would pop in every now and then, but he hadn't been kicked out yet by my mother. So then eventually...
So he would leave and come back and leave and come back and
yeah,
leave and come back.
And my mother, that's when my mother started suspecting that he was having an affair.
Okay.
And he was. So he would do that, and then she finally, with the help of Al-Anon, she finally... decided, you know what, this is not good for my kids. I really need for him not to be here.
So she found the strength to do something about this huge problem in the family.
Right.
Okay. Now, with that, did that affect you financially? Obviously, it affected you emotionally and psychologically. Did it also affect the family financially and economically?
Well, I think we were already affected economically and financially because my father would get his check on Thursdays and he would go to the bars and spend most of it.
On drinking?
Yes.
Yeah.
Drinking. So so my mother was struggling with how to raise her children.
Yeah. Okay. So, excuse me. So eventually your mother found out that he was taken up with another woman, a neighbor?
Not a neighbor, actually. My sister's friend invited my sister over after school. And they were several streets away from where we lived. And normally you would probably take a car to get to the other house. So my sister went over, and she walked in, and my father was there.
Okay.
And so she found out. Right.
Okay. Which your mother had suspected for a long time.
Correct.
Okay. All right. And would you consider yourself, were you close to your father growing up at all?
No. I mean, I even write in the book, I think I have like 12 positive memories of my father. Throughout my whole life. There are some really intimate and loving moments that I write about in the book that stay with me. But in general, I wouldn't say that we were close. You know, it was sort of like me being bounced on his knee when I was little, that kind of stuff.
That kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, when you were a kid, how did your mother explain your father's absence and abuse?
I don't know that there was any explanation for it. And I think it was so commonplace for us that we didn't even really know that fathers were supposed to be around more. Okay. The abuse is a little different. I mean, that scared us all. But I don't think my mother ever talked. Well, I don't remember talking with her about it anyways.
So your father allegedly, and I say that word because I want to, when we go further into this, I want to actually ask you if you still have any shadow of any doubts as to whether it was suicide or not. But before we get to that, your father allegedly died by suicide on your birthday.
Yes.
And you took that to heart.
I did. Actually, not until I wrote the book could I let go of my struggle around that whole coincidence. I remember struggling for years thinking that my father did this and there was some connection to me as to why he took his life on that day.
Because it was your birthday.
Because it was my birthday, right? Yeah. Was there something that happened that triggered bad memories for him? You know, that kind of stuff.
So you might have blamed yourself a little bit?
I don't know if I consciously blamed myself, but I think underlying things, it was there, and that was part of my sadness and my struggle. I know. When I wrote the book, that's when I did more research. I talked to, a few aunts and uncles. I talked to my mother. I talked to my brothers and sisters. So I got a wider perspective of things. And it was the first time where I really felt like they were right, that it didn't have anything to do with my birthday because my father didn't even keep track of such things.
Yeah, and so now you're convinced that was just coincidence.
I said coincidence before. Simultaneous occurrence, maybe, whatever.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. I've got a few questions here that's taken directly from your book. You mind if I ask them?
Sure, go ahead.
Great. In chapter 6 of your book, Unraveling My Father's Suicide, you mention mental torment went on intermittently for years. And when speaking of your own suicidal ideation, which we can talk about a little bit, that you also had that, you state, quote, when you were in one of your pockets, not quote, when you were in one of your pockets of fury and despair, you would angrily shout to yourself, quote, I'm going to show them. Who was the them? When you were angry and full of despair yourself.
Yep.
And you had this suicidal ideation, you're thinking to yourself, I'm just going to do it and I'm going to show them. Who is this them?
The them is, generically, it's anyone who I felt like they wronged me at some point. It could have been minor, it could have been big, didn't matter. It was all in there. So
you were angry at the world and particularly those who have wronged you in the past.
Correct. And I was also, like, for instance, one is that I was angry with my brothers and sisters and my mother because the thing around my birthday is they all just denied it, that there was any connection.
With your birthday?
With my birthday.
Okay.
And I think had they at least said, you know what, there might be, we just don't know. Instead, I felt like I was being told I was kind of like crazy.
Yeah, just dismissed as that's ridiculous. That
dismissed,
kind of thing.
Yeah. Right. So I was mad at them for that, you know. And I mean, there is, I think it's common with suicide that some people do. Well, I say common and some. I think it does happen that some people do it out of sort of like revenge. I'll show them. I'll get them back, kind of thing.
But there has to be a lot of inner anger for you to even feel that.
Oh, yeah.
And would you say that most of it was harbored anger with regard to your father? Or would you just say it was just the general stuff that, you know, most of us go through in life?
Oh, it wasn't just related to my father.
Okay.
It was related to my mother. My mother was a really good mother, but as far as emotional support, I think that was missing from our relationship.
Ah.
And so there was some anger about that. I mean, now, even now, it kicks in because I know what it should have been.
Mm.
You know?
Did your sisters feel the same way about that? Lack of emotional support?
As far as I know,
yeah.
I don't think so.
Okay.
And neither did my brothers.
Hmm. Okay. Did you talk about this? Did you talk about your father's death with your family? Did you talk that out enough? And did you ever talk with your family about your own desire for suicide when you were down?
I don't think I talked with my, I don't think I talked with my family much about any of that. That was one of the things that was such a reflection of our family relationships, is that we didn't talk about the emotional stuff going on inside. And so I think a lot of that ended up getting stuffed inside me, and not only did it build up my anger, but it also built up loneliness.
Yeah.
And, it made me feel distant from everybody. Yeah.
So you had a negligent father. You had a mother who did not give you emotional support. And it seems like you didn't really, were you all that close to your sisters and brothers?
No. Okay. I mean, and I'm not saying that that's their fault or anything.
Right.
I mean, I think it was due to the dynamics of our family. We just didn't get close. We didn't talk about things like that unless it was a really important issue, you know, but that's it.
Speaking of family dynamics, is it true that a person has a little more perhaps subconscious openness to the possibility of suicide themselves if it happens within the immediate family?
Yes, that's common. Actually, the statistic is that kids of parents who have taken their lives, they have a 50% more chance of taking their own lives.
Really?
Compared to children who are in families that's not involved.
Because something within them says this is an option, because it happened in my family, so this is a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of like, it reminds me of people a few generations ago who used to fight and fight and fight, but the thought, the possibility of divorce never even crossed their mind. They couldn't stand each other, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But once divorce began, here and there and here, then, of course, it became more accepted, more of a possibility in the minds of people. And, of course, it that tends to also perpetuate itself in families.
I do want to say one thing about my family knowing about... Wait, did we talk about my own attempt at suicide?
We had mentioned it briefly, yeah.
Right. I don't think I told any of them about that until I wrote the book. And that was... You know, 20 years later.
20 years after your father's?
No, 20 years after I did it.
Oh, okay. When did you attempt suicide yourself?
You know what? I need to write that down because I don't remember it right now.
Approximately how many years ago, if you were a ballpark figure?
Oh, I would say more than 20 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you happen to remember that horribly, horribly dark day in your life before you actually took the pills?
Oh yeah, I remember.
You do. Mm-hmm. Could you somehow articulate, maybe in a sentence or two, what your mind and heart were like that day before you did it?
Well, there was a lot of anger and there was a lot of confusion. I actually had admitted myself to a psychological hospital.
Oh.
And they gave me this doctor that I did not like, and they wouldn't change and give me somebody else.
So you were angry at that, too?
Yes. So at some point, I said, I want to leave because it's a voluntary, you know, admission.
Oh, okay.
And as long as you're not really, like, going to kill yourself, or they think, you know, like, or you try to in there, then they pretty much let you go.
Right.
So they let me go, and the doctor that I did not like signed my papers, and it was right after that, basically.
So you went home.
So I went home, yep.
And did you just started planning it? You said, this is how I'm going to do it?
Oh, no, I'd been planning it long before that.
Okay. All right. So you were having psychological problems for a while before that.
Before
your own suicide attempt.
Oh, before a suicide attempt? Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Doctors, medications, the whole nine yards.
Right.
Okay. And at one point after this, you just gave up? And is there any way you could articulate the pain that you were feeling that day? I don't. Like, a lot of people probably haven't felt that. Just, like, darkness?
Heaviness.
Heaviness.
Darkness. Loneliness. A sense of just giving up, because that's what I did.
In chapter 6 of your book, you state, I just wanted to stop the unending pain. I didn't care about the people I would leave behind, because if I did, it might puncture the Berlin Wall inside of me and open up the floodgates of unending pain and grief.
That captures it.
How scary was that?
I don't want to surprise you, but it wasn't scary.
Oh.
I mean, it was unnerving, and it was a little, I mean, it was a little scary, I guess, but I had been thinking about suicide for a while, and I had sort of thought about taking an overdose. I thought of all the different ways of taking my own life, and part of that struggle was I was worried that if I tried and attempted suicide, what if I didn't succeed? And then I ended up being, you know, like in a wheelchair or, you know, worse off in my life than before. So that was one of the deterrents. But at some point, it was just sort of a sense of giving up and convincing myself that even my kids didn't need me.
Wow.
You know, they had their dad, they had their aunts and uncles.
Right.
And there was no connection to them.
No. You say that were afraid that you wouldn't be successful in your suicide attempts.
Yes.
And the fallout there. Were you afraid at all that you would be successful? Were you afraid at all of what would happen to you after you died?
I think that I was in so much pain and heaviness and self-absorbed that I couldn't think about that. I mean, I was self-absorbed just in the moment that I got to get rid of my pain, and not just my temporary pain that day, but this was about pain that had been there for years and that I was sick of trying to deal with.
Help me understand. Isn't there a presumption in that the pain would go away if you died? There's that presumption, right?
There is.
But you were brought up a Catholic Christian.
I was.
And you knew that for those who were in their right mind, for those who did have free will, that intentionally ending one's own life is self-murder, and you may not end up for all eternity in the place that we all want to, that we're destined to.
Let me give you some perspective. I was raised Catholic until I was about 14, which is when a lot of people in my generation just left the church. they did got their confirmation, and then they left, and they never went to Mass, never got any further education,
by the way, that's very demonic in and of itself, that pattern.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what was I going to say? Okay. So I really didn't have much, and what I did have, I didn't have as far as suicide until later in life. I did have it when I was trying to take my life, though. But I just ignored it.
Yeah. You say in your book in Chapter 6 that you also battled a perceived abandonment by God. Now, to perceive being abandoned by God does presume some kind of belief in God, but it doesn't presume a trust in his love or goodness, does it?
No, that's right.
And that's what you felt? That God exists, but he's ignoring you or something like that?
Right, he's abandoned me. Kind of like my dad abandoned me. My dad does it, he does it.
Right. Okay.
Everybody does it, you know, it's just...
And that's how are you feeling at the time?
Yeah. Should we have a commercial?
Right. We need to take a break. You're listening to Beneath the Surface. Paul Morano here with my guest tonight, Kathleen LaPlante, author of Unraveling My Father's Suicide. We have a whole half a show left. We're going to delve into a lot more about this book and a lot more about Kathleen's life. Don't go away. Beneath the Surface. We'll be right back. And we're back. Beneath the Surface, WCAP Radio 980 on your dial. If you want to get in touch with us, 978-454-4980 is the Beneath the Surface hotline. 978-454-4980. My guest tonight is Kathleen LaPlante, and we're talking about her book, which you can get on Amazon.com, called Unraveling My Father's Suicide. Now, Kathleen, before the break, we were talking about how your father's suicide affected you and your family, and how you, as a result of perhaps that and many other things in your life colliding at the same time, also attempted suicide with pills, and thanks be to God, it was not "quote unquote" successful. Do you want to? I know you have some helplines that you want to communicate to the audience?
There's a couple things I want to say. Suicidal ideation, it doesn't just like happen once. For many people, and including myself, it can pop up at any time.
Okay.
So what is suggested is to have a suicide plan in place. If you think that you're, you know, if you think you're going to act on it, you need to talk to someone as the plan, then you need to go for a walk, you need to call your psychiatrist, maybe you need to go to the hospital if it's really bad, whatever, but have it in writing so you know, like, okay, you know what, this is what I need to do. And you have to override, and it's really hard, override all the emotion, the thinking, the negative thinking that comes up, and use logic to say, no, I am going to follow this plan, you know. And so along with that, you can also call the National Suicide Prevention Hotline. And I'll give you the number. It's 1-800-273-8255. You can also text. And it's the number you text is 741-741. And there are also, those are national. I mean, there are many local, you know, organizations that you can also call. Like here in Massachusetts, there's the Good Samaritans.
Okay.
You know, things like that.
Okay. So. I got on an IM that you said a suicide plan. You really meant to say a suicide prevention plan.
Oh, thank you. Yes. Suicide prevention plan. Oh, gosh.
So if anybody has these feelings or this ideation that you speak of, just before you have them, before they pop up, you should have a plan in place.
that you can develop with your therapist. Yeah. Or with, you know, yes. a good...
So you know exactly A, B, C, and D, what you're going to do in order to fight off these terrible thoughts in your mind.
Yeah, these
and
temptations,
feelings.
Yep.
These temptations, okay. Okay, let's get back to your book. In Chapter 9, there's a whole lot about the police report. And it amazes me, first and foremost, as a side, how bad police are in spelling. And you would several times you had to put in parentheses SIC because the spelling was so bad on this police report.
Right.
The grammar and so forth. But it states, quote, subject hung himself, talking about your father, subject hung himself with a black belt on the bedroom doorknob. That's hard to imagine.
It is hard to imagine.
Because
but
doorknobs are
before
low.
Before we go there, I just okay. want to say one other thing about... Oh, I forget it. Okay. So, yes, it's hard to imagine. And so it caused a great deal of, you know, tension and disagreement in my family.
Did any of you, and I know you wrote this in your book, you had at least some thoughts about it not being suicide?
Yes.
Where are you with that now? Do you still at least open the is the possibility open in your mind right now that it might not have been suicide?
No.
Why?
Based on the description of things in the police report of my father at the time, and I also talked to the coroners for the state of New Hampshire, and you know, explained what was what, and they were convinced that it was a suicide.
Hmm.
And the way she described it to me, I was convinced of what she was saying. So,
yeah, when it was described in your book, I'm thinking maybe it wasn't because this is a. I don't see how you can do it that way, but.
Oh, and that's one of the things the coroner said is that actually people do it quite often.
Okay. You mentioned in your book also that your grandfather died on a boating accident, and there were some questions about that as to whether he actually took his own life. Do you have any doubts about that now?
I still have doubts about that. No, wait, I don't. I have doubts about that he didn't take his life. So I still... kind of lean towards that he might have.
He might have.
But,
yeah.
You know, most of my relatives and, again, newspaper reports, it doesn't strongly support it, so it's hard to tell.
Yeah. Now, then you're probably assuming that he didn't, but you're thinking that it might be possible. And if that's...
No, I'm not assuming that he didn't.
Oh, really?
If anything, I assume that he did.
Ah, yeah,
I think maybe in the book I might have said didn't.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm
but
not sure.
But the reports, the official reports say that it was an accident.
The newspaper articles, yeah.
Okay.
And I just want to say, like, I was just so blessed to be able to go back to Manchester, go to the library, and look through all their microfiche. And that's how I found the article about my grandfather and his. They were looking for him for 10 days because he was missing, and then to also be able to go to the police department and get copies of reports, you know, of every time my father was arrested that we didn't know about was there, and his suicide report was there, obviously, and things like that.
Yeah, so you get to know a lot that you didn't know when you were younger.
Yes.
By reading all of this stuff. Did you make copies of it?
Oh, yes, I have copies of it all.
Okay. Did your mother and your siblings have access to this?
Sure. I mean, it's public domain. Yeah. Anybody has access to it if you can think of doing it.
At one point in Chapter 9, your sister Diane felt better because... Your father, she says, or she decided, was a victim of his own vices, quote unquote.
Yes.
How can we possibly know the level of culpability somebody has when it comes to this?
We can't.
We can't. So even making that judgment is a little...
That's right. It's...
And I know earlier in the book you were mentioning, you know, it was so important for you to know where to forgive and where he was guilty and where he wasn't, that kind of thing.
Right.
I don't see how that's all that. I mean, you can take, I suppose, guesses, but can you really know the culpability of somebody when they do something like this?
No, and I think in my book I talk about that, that bottom line is that we don't know. You know, God's the only one that knows.
Yeah, and you're a Catholic now.
Yes.
And so you believe that's what the Church teaches, that somebody has to be in their right mind psychologically, and they have to freely choose it, which means they are rejecting one of God's greatest gifts to us, which is life itself, deliberately and consciously. Then, of course, you know, if they don't repent on their way towards their death, the only, logic would tell us the only eternal destiny for them is hell, because they reject. Now,
but that's true of everybody.
And that's true of everybody.
Right.
Now, the question is, you know, with suicide victims or those who die from suicide, you know, did they have, you know, what kind of knowledge did they have, and, you know, what level of consent did they give in doing this? And I suppose you could even say if they did have proper knowledge and if they did give full consent, then there's still that time while the person is actually leaving this world that they could
repent
and cry out to God before they're gone. And that could be a possibility of, I don't know, salvation.
Mm-hmm.
So the bottom line, I guess, here is we don't judge anybody because that's God's job, including suicide victims.
Right. And this is my personal, in church, a lot of times funerals, I've attended many funerals, and I can tell you why later, but, I've attended many funerals, and so many of them just talk about the person going to heaven.
Mm.
Now, I'm not saying that we have to say that he's damned to hell, but I think we should be encouraging people to pray for these people so that when they do leave this earth, that maybe our prayers are going to make a difference in their salvation.
Interesting. And I suppose there are two ways to think about that. One is if you believe in a purgatory-type state.
Right.
And another is if you believe that God could take your prayers and apply them retroactively to the person as they're dying.
Right, which I do, yeah.
Because God is outside of time. And, okay. So, yeah, so then prayer for people is traditional and very important. And there's been, of course, 2,000-year tradition of that in the Christian church. All right. Do you pray for your father?
I do.
Hmm.
And I pray for all my sisters. I pray for everybody, basically.
Your mother passed away a couple of years ago?
5 years ago.
5 years. Wow, time flies.
I was going to say, I pray for you.
Oh, you do?
I do.
Awesome.
And your wife.
Fabulous. Boy, do we need it. No.
Yes, my mother passed away 5 years ago. We had a 75th surprise birthday party for her in September, and she was not feeling well at all.
Mm.
And 3 months later is when she passed away.
Okay. So hopefully, by God's grace, they are together with each other and with God. But only God knows.
Right.
All right. So, let's see. Lots to cover in 12 minutes. You talked about when you were in college, you got married. No, right after college, you got married.
Correct.
Okay.
Yep.
And that marriage ended up in divorce. You had two wonderful children.
An annulment.
Yeah, and you're annulled, so it wasn't. It's considered not a valid marriage
in the eyes of the Church.
Yeah, which we believe are the eyes of God. So, was this? I mean, a lot of people would say divorce would actually hit them harder than death in the family. So, and you didn't really talk much about it in your book. Did divorce hit you hard?
Definitely.
Oh, it did. Okay.
Yes. Especially for me, I was the non-custodial parent, and my two sons lived with their dad, and he was the primary caretaker. So I had a lot of struggles with that, you know. As much as I thought that was the best arrangement for my two sons, it was still a struggle. There was shame associated with it. And that's the other thing in my family, just the dynamics, it creates a lot of shame, you know, that just kind of seeps into your bones. So anyways, yeah, there was a lot of shame about it, and it was definitely a struggle.
Yeah. And
that's when I tried to take my own life and did a suicide attempt. I was living by myself.
Loneliness,
right.
Depression, lack of hope. At least you felt that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You mention in the appendix, the first appendix, you have, I think, three appendix at the end?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think I have more, but yeah.
Okay. In appendix number one, you mentioned that similar to those with a suicidal ideation, those considering euthanasia or physician-assisted suicide also need help because, and here's your quote, they are not in their right minds and they're all missing God in their lives as well as the truth about the power of suffering when united to Christ on the cross. That is a huge statement. Could you unpack that a little bit?
Well, my son's stepmother just passed away after a 10-month battle with brain cancer.
Okay.
And it was the first time where I really saw someone struggling with all of their pain in that fashion. But she was battling it out. She was staying alive as long as she could. I did question myself and said, you know, like, is this an instance where you would say it's okay for her to take her own life because it's so painful and that's the only direction it's going in.
I see.
You know, but she didn't do that. And I guess I just do feel that. Now, I also know that I'm human and that when I am in all of that pain, if I have cancer or whatever, I mean, I know I'm in pain anyways, right? Because depression causes a lot of pain.
Right.
But if I'm in the pain of, you know, the cancer, say, I don't, you know, it's painful. It hurts.
Yes.
And
pain,
you know,
is not fun.
I just hope that I'm strong enough to live out what I believe.
Right. Could you talk a little bit about the theological insight, though, that those who are faithful can offer up their own pain and suffering in union with Jesus on the cross in order for the salvation of souls? What does that mean, say, for the non-Christian who's listening to the show? What does that mean to you?
Well, I'm not a non-Christian.
No, I know.
So
that's, I'm telling you,
yes,
to teach them.
It is through my mother's death, my father's death, my son's stepmother's death, and even my own depression and my own suicidal temptations, have I learned more and more to mentally put myself on the cross with Jesus, who is up there for our salvation and for mercy and forgiveness. And and it's for the whole world. And so I can join in with him and provide some of that. I mean, not to get too heady, but provide some of that to other people. And sometimes when I do it, I actually ask it be for my son, maybe, or for, you know, whatever.
And this is a tradition that has been around since the very beginning. this notion of the church is the extended body of Christ, who is the head. And so the head is not only does not only suffer for the salvation of the world, but also the body does. And so in uniting your suffering, whether it be, you know, depression related or what have you, or physical pain, when you have the wherewithal to unite your suffering to Christ on the cross, you participate in that salvation of the world, and you could save souls by doing that.
Right.
One day you might enter heaven and meet all of these souls that you have actually saved that might have been destined for hell had you not offered up your suffering in these ways.
Right.
So you see that as a positive that can come out of a great negative.
Well, it helps to manage the pain. And it helps to lift you up a little bit because you feel like you're doing something really good for the kingdom, you know.
Yes.
So, but I'm noticing the clock. Do you want to talk about hope?
Yeah. First, tell me where you are in your life right now.
Where I am in my life? Well, I'm in a radio station giving an interview.
You've had deeper and deeper conversion in your faith, no?
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't just stop.
Yeah,
it definitely happened when I came back into the church, and that's what kept me going. But it just in life, you know, it happens in general. But
So, where can we go with all of this with regard to hope and joy? Because that's really what we're here for in this life.
Well, I would go back to uniting myself to Christ on the cross.
Okay.
There's a real joy in being able to participate in the salvation of others. Mm. And also just in the distribution of Jesus' mercy, things like that. So that comes. But also, even as depressed as I can get sometimes, there is an underlying river of joy, of not happiness per se, but of joy that that's like glad I'm alive, I'm glad I'm connected to Jesus,
yes,
and things like that.
Now, and you are blessing everyone else by being alive.
Mm.
I mean, God really gave you such a gift by disabling all of those pills that you took that one day to work as you wanted it that night. And now I understand in your book you lost 24 hours. You woke up like 2 days, right?
Later, yeah.
Yeah, 2 days later. But you were alive. You went to the hospital and you got over that. You mention in your book the old saying that suicide is a temporary... What could you say it?
Suicide is a temporary solution. Wait a minute. What is that?
A permanent solution.
A permanent solution to a temporary problem. Right.
Yeah. And nothing can be more true than that. You can't wake up from that.
It's true. Like, yeah. That's it. Once it's done. And that's kept me alive sometimes, is to say, if I do this, that's it. Like, there's no coming back.
And so you're alive, you know, 20 years later, at least. You're alive. You have this underlying joy and peace. And even though you still have that psychological disposition, you're saying, to depression, you're able to overcome that, to fight that, and to still live in that underlying river of joy that you mentioned.
Yes. And it's not easy by any means. It's easier, though, compared to when I didn't have it. Yes.
Is there any tips that you could give people who might be in the same boat that you're in? Or that you were in?
I think, well, obviously therapy, and if you need it, medication.
Okay.
And medication can be really challenging, but stick with it, because that's what I had to do, or that's what I chose to do. And I found, you know, something that worked relatively well for me. You know, friends and family, any real people that you can trust Mm. And your therapist is one too, where you can open up about what you're feeling. If, you know, if you're thinking suicidally, it helps so much to get it out. Like it does right. with a lot. I mean, that's what therapy yeah. does.
And would you say that it's very important to avoid alienation and loneliness in your life?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I just posted an article about loneliness on Twitter mm. and how loneliness, above all the other stuff, poverty, you know, gender, whatever, tends to map out with suicide rates
yeah.
much more closely than anything else.
And we really have a problem with that today, I think, especially with technology that we have. It's supposed to bring us all together, and it kind of alienates us at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
You know? A lot of people sort of have these virtual relationships. I just read an article online about how it's becoming more popular for millennials and younger to have these virtual relationships for months, if not years at a time, with people they never meet.
Mm. Well, now, I don't know. I suppose that happens on Twitter and Facebook to some extent.
But they don't call them friends. They call them, you know, their boyfriend and girlfriend.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, they're an item, and they've never touched, they never met in person.
They don't even know if they like their looks.
Or have that kind of chemistry. It's just very interesting.
Right.
Very bizarre.
I just want to say thank you for having me, and I hope that people are able to benefit from what I've shared and things that you've asked.
Thank you. And the helpline one more time?
1-800-273-8255 or text 741-741.
Thanks be to God for you, and thanks be to God for this show. My name is Paul Morano. That was Kathleen LaPlante, author of Unraveling My Father's Suicide. Find it on Amazon.com. Thanks for listening, and God bless you all. We'll see you next time.